Talking Records Podcast, Talking Records Podcast, Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records, Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track-by-track breakdown of all the songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Hey, what's up, everyone? My name is Jed, and you're listening to the Talking Records Podcast, a podcast with a singular goal of gathering as much information as possible about great albums. If you're into knowing the backstories, the context, the people behind the scenes, and all those details, you've come to the right place. In just a moment, I'll be joined by Bad Religion guitarist Brian Baker. Now, anyone who knows me knows I'm a massive Bad Religion fan, and The Gray Race is my favorite album by the band. I've been wanting to cover this album since I started this podcast, so having Brian on is a huge thrill.
Be sure to follow Talking Records on social media. We can be found on Instagram at Talking Records Podcast. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and even YouTube. Give us a like or a follow, and we'll try to keep fresh content coming your way daily. You can also visit our website by going to TalkingRecordsPodcast.com. There you will find episodes, merch, and more. You can even drop us an email at TalkingRecords@Outlook.com. These are all great ways for us to connect with you over all the great music we enjoy. We would love to get this podcast in front of even more music lovers, and you can help by providing us with a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume podcasts, as every review helps us reach more listeners. Thanks, everyone, and let's continue with the podcast.
The Gray Race was released on February 27th, 1996 on Atlantic Records. The album was recorded at Electric Lady Studios in New York, and was produced by Cars frontman Rick Ocasek. Like many, I had heard Green Day in 94. I knew what punk was, thanks to my dad and his collection of Ramones and MC5 records. But it wasn't until I placed a blank tape into my stereo and recorded 90 minutes worth of a hard rock station out of Boston that I got mostly guitar-heavy grunge out of, but nestled in the middle was something that really caught me. As I listened through, suddenly a D chord was vigorously ringing out before a voice called out, "I'm going for a walk." The song chugged along at a medium pace, and I was mesmerized by the preciseness of the music and the message, the thoughtful lyrics. These weren't obnoxious kids whining into a microphone. It's cliche to say it, but I'll say it anyway. Everything changed in that moment. This was the music for me. I picked up the album immediately. The CD jewel case slid into a cardboard cover, and I listened to the album over and over and over again. In 96, I didn't have the internet yet. There was no way I could learn anything more about this band. I actually wrote a letter to Rolling Stone magazine requesting information on back issues that might have stories about the band. I know. I was young and naive. Give me a break. I was able to get the band's first five albums from my friend Donna, who graciously squeezed them onto two tapes. I loved all of it. I loved The Gray Race right away, and though I love and appreciate albums like No Control, Suffer, and Stranger Than Fiction, this album always maintained a tight grip on my interest. For a while, I thought it was sentimental. This was my first Bad Religion album. You always have a soft spot for your first. It wasn't until I read Do What You Want, The Story of Bad Religion, that I was able to understand that it was more than sentiment. The Gray Race is an emotional album. The book points out that it's not a concept album, but it does serve as a careful examination of the human species. The book points out that we are the only species on the planet that can see things in terms other than black and white, e.g. fight or flight, kill or be killed, etc. Humans can perceive a middle ground, but as the book points out, humans continually create systems that encourage, if not enforce, a black and white duality to existence. The album's central theme is we need to come together, find new ways to coexist, or we'll all be doomed. I didn't know at the time that vocalist Greg Graffin had intensely worked on these songs to prove he could manage without longtime collaborator Brett Gurewitz. Knowing that now only solidifies in my mind that this is a spectacular album. In 1996, I would start my own band and call it No Intention, based on the line, "I have no grand ideas or intentions of sticking around," from A Walk. Here to tell us more about the making of The Gray Race is guitarist Brian Baker. I'm excited to dig into this record with you.
Yeah, well, I remember a lot about it. I don't like the cover.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, that's committee. That's major label committee action right there.
Oh, interesting.
But, yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a fun record. Obviously, for me, it's interesting because it's the first one I did.
That's right.
With Bad Religion.
All right. So I think the story, well, maybe it starts before this, but I feel like it begins when you came on to play guitar in support of the Stranger Than Fiction tour. And so tell me a little bit about that, and how long did you have to prepare all that material?
It wasn't crazy. I had a couple of months.
Oh, that's good.
Because Brad had left the band before the record, I think even before it came out.
Yeah.
So there was some lag time. And in that period of time, I had to, I kind of tried out, but they just were like, "Okay, well, you're the guy," which was cool.
Yeah,
I appreciate that because they were stuck for time, and I understand that. You know, I was just in the right place at the right time. I was in an awesome place. I was playing in Bash and Pop with Tommy Stinson.
Oh, really?
At that time.
In the replacements?
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, which of course, like, I just wanted to be in that band because I worshiped Tommy Stinson.
Yeah,
which is a perfectly good reason.
Absolutely.
And it was really fun, but the opportunity, you know, everything was kind of happening at once for me at that time. So the Bad Religion opportunity came, and I took that over other options. Mm-hmm. And the only caveat was that I had told them that I could sing, and I was lying. So
anything to get in the door, right?
Yeah. By the time Greg found out that I really couldn't sing, it was far too late because the cat was out of the bag. And I did know how to play. I learned the songs. I did not misadvertise the ability to play punk rock guitar.
Yeah.
So at least I brought, you know, 75% of what was promised to the situation. But Greg was very forgiving, and he said that, you know, agreed you may not be a seasoned singer, but he told me I had the gene. And he really tried. He helped me very much. So I was in kind of singer camp with Greg.
Oh, nice.
And so in that let's just call it a couple of months time between knowing I was doing it and going off, we managed to do that. And I learned a lot of songs, but they, you know, I've watched other new guys come and in our band. And it's like, you really just have to learn on the job.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It just happens over time. And fortunately, every single person who's joined has kind of gotten, you know, got it together almost as quickly as I did. Drumming doesn't count because that you can just play anything. I missed a cymbal.
Well, I feel like it's almost like cramming.
Yeah, it is. It was like cramming.
It's a lot at once. You're trying to learn all these songs. It's like my memory would be like overheated or something.
Well, the problem for me was multiplied by the fact that I wasn't really familiar with all of their really important great records from the 80s and early 90s, because I kind of missed them. Like I knew How Could Hell Be Any Worse because I got that right when it came out. And then I had Recipe for Hate, which I loved. I had gotten that record long before I was asked to be in the band. So I knew those, like, that was easy because these are songs I listened to, you know, 50, 60 times each.
Yeah.
But the other stuff just was hard. But, you know, there's something, I know it's the old Bad Religion thing, like, well, a lot of the songs sound the same. And the fact is a lot of the music sounds the same, but the lyrics aren't. But for me, the difference between at that time, you know, Index Fossil or Suffer or, you know, just all of these, it was kind of a blur. And I just something clicked finally. And I just was like, I don't overthink it. And, you know, Brett was helpful too, because even though, you know, the camps were split, I was still friendly with Brett because I had known him for a long time because he put out Dag Nasty records. So it wasn't like he sat down and showed me how to play guitar, but he was very encouraging about just relax. You know, it's not as precision a thing as you might think.
It's good to have that blessing.
For sure.
So shortly after the 10-month Stranger Than Fiction tour, the band began writing songs for this album, The Grey Race. And so what was the feeling like approaching this album without longtime co-songwriter Brett?
Well, I'm sure it was terrifying for Greg because they had both, you know.
His partner.
Yeah, it was his partner. And the way those guys write is that they both just write complete songs. And they'll write 10 songs each and decide which 15 are going on the record. It's basically how it works and how it still does today. Whereas I've never been, very few exceptions, I've never been a whole song guy. I've been a collaborative guy. And what I would generally, in everything I've done, I would have either the music for a song or at least a, you know, a hook or a riff. And then the person who was going to sing the song would be the lyricist or would be, it would be, you know, we'd work together. I've never brought a complete song in to any band. You know, think about Greg, who's now, he's got to shoulder basically the whole thing.
Yeah.
I did come up with songs and I did, you know, I mean, the record, I don't know the count. I'd have to listen to the record to identify things that I might have helped with or not, but you know, he basically had to be the one who took all of my raw material and synthesized it into something that he could sing to that would sound like a song. And I'm very grateful. I mean, that's why he's talented. He can do that.
Yeah. Well, that's always cool to be able to do that, to have enough lyrics around that you can sort of mold it over the top of something that somebody else brings in.
Yeah. And he's constantly writing lyrics. I mean, I'm sure he has lyrics for 500 songs that we haven't heard. without question. That's just how he is. Greg is always writing. So I'm very grateful and it did work out. I mean, there's some cool stuff on there, I think.
Yeah. There's a lot of cool stuff on there. Greg had mentioned that this album offered him a chance to try new things, like without compromise. You know, now that you don't have the other person, you can kind of do, you know, your thing. Do you recall what sort of like new experimental things Greg tried on this record?
I can't specifically. I never thought about that as being free from Brett. I thought of it more like, oh, shit, where's Brett? Yeah. His behavior wasn't like that, but I can't point to specific songs that say this is the ones that sound the least like previous Bad Religion are the ones that like Grey Race or Streets of America, where I had a big chunk of the music, and that's why they don't sound like Bad Religion. I mean, the Grey Race sounds like a Dag Nasty Minor Threat song, but with Greg Graffin singing it and hitting multiple awesome harmonies. You know, it really does sound like a meld. The majority of the stuff which Greg wrote from top to bottom, all of his stuff, just sounds like it sounds like what you do after Stranger Than Fiction. It seemed to be kind of in line, at least to my ears, to where Bad Religion was going, which is, you know, maintaining that those elements of the early stuff, but being able to play the music better and just knowing more about making music, the better you get at it, the things change, they tweak.
Yeah, it sounds like they were really on the same page a lot. So losing one is not going to send the other into a completely different direction.
I think I will say that the band is better when they're both in it. Having, you know, I mean, there's just no question. Those two are the way you just can't replace it. And I think it's kind of cool that Greg, you know, he wasn't trying to replace Brett. It was a time, this was just a shift in the play. And, you know, I think that's why some of the, you know, at least the Grey Race is still pretty successful to me, like as far as a Bad Religion record, because of that.
So I had read somewhere that Greg had actually sent out demos to the rest of the band to solicit opinions, something that he hadn't really done in the past. Is that true? Did he do that?
I think he did, but every record we've done with him or with him and Brett, there's been demos.
Like, oh, Brett, okay. So that wasn't a new thing.
Yeah, well, they both have studios at home and they both love the recording process. I mean, Brett specifically, I mean, he's, you know, that's what he's really become. He's such a recording engineer. So yeah, I would, for every record, I would get songs from everybody. And to be honest, Greg's stuff is more fleshed out. Brett's is a little more idea, whereas Greg will, there's some demos that Greg has that just sound exactly like a record because he's
oh, wow.
really talented at making that stuff.
And he plays all the instruments on it?
Yeah, well, Greg, that's another thing. Greg plays, I mean, the drums are always Mr. Machinery of some sort, but actually, that's not even fair. There are times when he's had, when Bobby was in the band, and I think even Brooks, where they would play on the demos. And I know Brooks has played on some of Brett's demos, but Greg plays guitar yeah. and bass and piano, and obviously he can sing. You know, all the harmony parts are pretty easy for him. And that's a lot, I think, why yeah. he makes such a accurate representation of his songs in demo form is because if you're running all these complicated vocal harmonies, it's good to be able to solo them and go like, oh, that's the, that one, that's the one, you know, to find it.
Yeah.
I will go even further to tell you that often backing vocals that are on both of their demos wind up on the record.
Really? Wow.
Well, they're all using the same format, and you can just, if there's a specific performance that Brett did that was great and you can't recreate it, well, just let's fly it in from the demo.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'd also read that you and Bobby flew out to Ithaca to spend a couple of weeks with Greg at his home studio. What did you guys work on out there?
That was like, I think that might have been vocal camp.
/,
like get it together camp. I think that might have been part of it. Though I was out there many times, and I think Bobby too. I mean, it was a thing to go up to Greg's house. Mm-hmm. So it could have been definitely in the songwriting part of it. I know it had to have been when we were kind of figuring out how the songs go, because it also works out because Greg has a house where there's a drum set and there's amps and stuff, and Greg can play bass. So if it's just the three of us, we can still rehearse either a new song or Bad Religion songs. So we did it many times. I wish I could pinpoint exactly when and what happened, but that's lost to the ages.
Yeah. Well, it's great to imagine, you know, it's great to imagine you guys heading out there and, like, you know, I don't know, playing in the garage or wherever
yeah.
and fleshing out these songs. So,
yeah.
Did you get a chance to hike around and check out the gorges?
Yeah, I did a lot of Ithaca time, and we recorded a subsequent record in Ithaca, No Substance. Mm-hmm. And so I lived in Ithaca for at least a month with Jay Bentley in like a little rental house that was kind of, you know, a little bit rural. It's just, the place is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And, just a great vibe. I've always loved Ithaca. It was the first time I went to a Wegmans. I mean,
oh yeah,
I broke my Wegmans cherry, which was kind of, didn't even know what that was as a DC kid, you know.
Yeah,
but no, it's always great to get up there, and I still go up. You know, I mean, I've been up to see Greg just because we're friends. It doesn't have to be a work meeting.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You're on the East Coast as well.
Yeah, I'm in New Jersey now, so it's really easy.
Nice. And so for the actual recording, it seems like you guys took like a live approach to the recording. Is that how it shaped out?
Well, we did what Rick Ocasek wanted, which was you do exactly what he tells you because he's Rick and he knows what he's doing. So if he had me playing, you know, in a cement mixer that was driving down 54th Street, I would have done it. But it seemed to me to be pretty common. I mean, I'd done a lot of kind of big major label records by then. And we were in a fantastic studio with a huge room in Electric Lady in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And you record like you want to keep everything, but you generally wind up, you know, if you're lucky, you keep the drums. And if you're lucky, you can keep some of the guitars. But there's, you know, you kind of go back and use that big room, you know. Take advantage of it. So I don't recall it being in any way different than any other approach.
Yeah.
It's just kind of how it always seems to flesh out.
I always like to get a sense of how bands like to approach recording, because like you said, some people like to try to keep those scratch tracks, while others will automatically just go back in and spend more time on tones and try to get the guitar parts.
I think I love to keep the scratch if possible. I always want to have a good guitar sound. But in some studio situations, if I have to be in an ISO booth, my amps have to be isolated, and I know that I'm getting a good sound, but I don't know if it's the best sound. You know, I will always play as if it's a keeper. but a lot of times it really just isn't. And not to belittle it, but like playing the rhythm guitar on a Bad Religion song is not rocket science. And if you want me to play that minute 50 song again, but this time my amp is in a huge wood room with 10 mics, I'm going to play it the same way I played. You know, there's no real nuance to the basic tracking. That all comes in, you know, that's like overdub candy. So it's either way is fine for me, but I always play to win.
Yeah. So I want to go back to Rick for a moment. I'm interested. How'd you connect with him? Why bring Rick in?
Well, that was like a major label decision that was kind of, my recollection is one of these, like, well, you know, we were thinking about Rick Ocasek and us going, yes, yes, that would be great. Yes, get him. Yes. Yes, we love the Cars. And I loved Rock for Light, his Bad Brains thing. I mean, the cred alone was there. I knew he was cool and I knew he was a great songwriter. But it was really his experience with the Bad Brains, because that means that he was in our world. And especially Bad Brains being, you know, like these are the guys that I looked up to when I was an infant. From my town. It was just cool for me. So we were really lucky that he was available and interested. And he also made a really good record. It's just, it still sounds amazing. And
it sounds fantastic.
He turned out to be an awesome man. Just what a pleasure. What a joy that I got to know him. And then I spent time with him. That's irreplaceable. He's so great.
I'm sure you learned a lot from him as well. I know on Rock for Light, he was pretty hands-off. He just wanted to sort of capture what Bad Brains were going to bring in.
True.
Was
he was less so with us. I think Bad Brains also, that was definitely more experimental. That was the first run at this. And it was, you know, it also predated Grey Ray significantly. And we were doing a proper record. I mean, this is after he had done some Weezer time. So we were definitely using the big time producer who happened to be cool. And we loved the way that the Weezer, the Blue Album sounded great. I loved how it was powerful and dry at the same time. And it still doesn't sound dated, which is pretty amazing. That's what a good producer does. So, you know, it was just really lucky. And this is one of the advantages with being on Atlantic, is they could afford to pay him. I mean, obviously at the end of the day, we wind up paying him. I mean, I don't want to pretend to not know how things work, but you know, at the time, it's just there's a communication line that exists that doesn't if you're just doing it at home and going like, well, maybe someone will want to do it, you know?
Right. That's awesome. I imagine that was quite an experience. And can you remember like any standout production moments where he was like, no, try this or don't do that, try that? Do you remember anything like that?
Well, yeah, but not, you know, I wish I could, like, if I had known it was going to be for posterity, I would remember specifics, like real specifics. But I know that he would do little nudge. Everything that he would suggest would be right. And he wouldn't suggest things all the time. He wasn't a producer who just thought that he needed to look like he was participating by unnecessarily moving chords around or saying, only do that three times instead of four. Like I've worked with many, many producers and sadly the majority of them tended to be just like, well, I have to produce something. And Rick didn't have to do that. And so his input had value because it was infrequent and it was always the right answer, which was great. So it's, you know, I wish I could give you specific examples, but I do remember every time it was something like, hey, hold on. Why don't you try this? And us going, oh boy, wow, he's smarter than us. Look at that. It's so much better now.
You know? The guy who wrote Just What I Needed is telling me to do this. I better do it.
Yeah, it was cool. So he was just, and he was just such a nice man too. He was not, he had no attitude. He wasn't like, you know, he wasn't pissing in the corner and marking territory. He was genuinely excited about making the best Bad Religion record that we could make.
That's great.
Yeah, refreshing.
And I heard he had asked you at one point to join his solo band.
I did join his solo band.
Oh, you did join it? Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, I played on his solo record, and I toured It was the tour was truncated. We were supposed to do maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 shows. And I think we wound up doing 3 or 4 before he decided, like, I don't really feel like going on tour.
Schlepping it across the country. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, you know, we're all in like the van coming home from Philly. And I think Rick is just like, I don't really care that much. And then power to him. I had no idea what he was thinking anyway, you know, like why he would want to do it. But there's a record called Troubleizing. And I was in the band with Melissa Oftemauer from Hole. And Billy Corgan played on it too, but not while I was around. And it's a cool record. It's got some cool songs on it. And, you know, I'm really glad he asked me.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm going to have to check that out. And what a thrill it must have been to, like, have that opportunity.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And we also had Greg Hawks was in the band. So I had two guys from the Cars, and we played a couple of Cars songs. So nice. I'm like, I remember being in Boston on stage at, I don't remember the club, but it wasn't very big, and playing just what I needed with Rick singing and playing guitar and Greg Hawks playing keyboard. And I'm playing the guitar solo. I'm playing the right-handed version of the Elliott Easton guitar solo. And you're like, holy fuck. Like, what is, I'm like, you know, I'm like 30 and I've been punk most of my life. I was just like, so one of those overwhelming moments. It's like, wow, that was really cool. I never really played the solo right because it's too hard, but I made it, you know.
How could you?
It was convincing. I mean, it would have fooled anyone except for someone who really knows how great Elliott Easton is.
Yeah. Well, at least your mind didn't go totally blank up there on stage. As soon as you heard that, like, that keyboard line, like that iconic line, what am I doing?
I am a professional. if anything, I am a professional.
So in the book Do What You Want, The Story of Bad Religion, it is pointed out that there were some tense moments with Greg Hetson concerning songs he'd worked on. How are you guys able to smooth all that out?
Well, that's why you have a good producer like Rick. I mean, basically, Greg had some ideas that he had and brought to the band before I was in the band that were just not completed songs. And I think they just weren't, Greg just didn't have a place for them. You know, this is, Greg is really, as I said, he's shouldering the whole burden. And so it was like, well, I just don't, you know, there's nothing that, I guess there was nothing that Greg brought that Greg heard that he could make something out of. And that was really the only thing. And I'm sure, and Greg was disappointed, but like I've had my stuff shot down still to this day. You know, I know it's like, it sucks because you think you've got something that's really going to help and nobody wants it. And that happens to all of us. That's the deal. That's called being in a band. And that's songwriting. So that was really the only thing. I mean, I don't think it was like some horrifying tension, you know, it was just,
Yeah.
I think I only read the book when it came out. And I remember it was like a schoolyard thing, like, well, fuck you, man. You know, like kids do, because we were still, even if we were just in our early 30s, we were still permanent children because of being musicians.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there was, you know, I remember there was like, well, fuck you, mama, blah. And then the next day you're at the bar together. It doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, it's just a whisper in time.
Yeah, the studio can be intense. I mean, you're together a lot. You're working on something that you're trying to craft. And I imagine it can get pretty tense sometimes.
Sure, it does. And, you know, some people deal with it differently than others. I mean, there's no end to the amount of stories of all bands, you know, especially ones we've heard of having flare-ups in the studio. And it's because you're putting out your actual, you're giving really the most personal part of yourself when you're providing, you know, showing people the results of your work. And it's hard, you know, and they're not all going to be winners. This is something actually with Greg and I that we say still to this day, is that even when, you know, he's written 10 songs and a couple of them just don't make it. And we're just like, well, they're not all going to be winners.
Right.
Not all going to be winners. And so, you know, you just have to accept it.
Yeah. You have to have thick skin.
Yep.
So as a guitarist, I'm just interested, what kind of gear do you remember what kind of gear you used on this record?
Yeah, I had, I would have probably been playing my own stuff. Definitely would have been 100-watt Marshall 412 cabinets. This was not a situation where there weren't a lot of weird little amps. this was at a time where it was about getting the best kind of, you know, I mean, basically my guitar sound is just AC/DC. Let's be honest. And and that even my playing is basically like, I don't know how I got into this punk thing, but I mean, that's how I play. And so I was playing, I was playing my favorite Les Paul Deluxe that had been cut for humbuckers. So it's like a 73 Deluxe Cherry Sunburst, beaten to shit, but never broken. With a DiMarzio Super Distortion in it from the 70s, through, I guarantee it was one of my 100 watt Marshall heads, or maybe the studio, like Electric Lady, of course, has this incredible array of amazing equipment they've passed over the decades. It might have been like a better Marshall head than mine, or, you know, you A, B, M, and like, oh boy, that one's better than mine. We should use theirs. But nothing weird. There was no weird pedal situation. Just pretty straight up. Yeah,
there aren't like a lot of crazy effects on this. And it being 90, well, you must have recorded it in 95. It came out in 96.
Yeah.
That was a time where you definitely didn't have at your disposal all these like plugins and computery things.
No.
That people have now.
Bad Religion wasn't really a pedally band. What you did have, though, was a really good board, and you'd have good old compressors, and, you know, the rack stuff of that era is just what all of this modern stuff is just based on that. But in Electric Lady, they have it. They have the real ones from, you know, the 60s and 50s, and just this, you know, irreplaceable equipment that sounds amazing. So, you know, that was, it was perfect for its time. And it's, I'm sure that stuff is still in line on everything that goes on at that studio, because you can't beat it.
You know, bands bring in their road beaten gear, that it must be nice to have options on the walls to take guitars down and try them out. And
yeah, I've never really had any luck with the guitars. It's about the amps that they have. And as my recording many records continued on, once we got into Bad Religion records of, you know, the 21st century, there's a lot of cool little amps. And, you know, Brett is anything that Brett's had to do with, he's always trying new stuff. And so I don't even know what I'm playing out of for the most part, because he'll set up stations and they'll be, you know, there's an old Marshall half stack, and then there's a high watt into like a 112 fucking 75 watt Celestion. It's like a little flabby. And then, you know, a couple of super old Fenders, you know, like little brown amps and just weird shit. And he's got them all going, and then he kind of picks and chooses with the faders. Like, you know, it's really much more of a science, but it's never like Pro Tool. It's not plugins. It has to be a real, well, it has been a real amps and real guitars, because
that's great.
You know, I there's a place for everything. I mean, I play with a Kemper live now, so I'm certainly not like this purist, but the Kemper is simply a profile of my own Marshall amp.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's just my amp, except for it doesn't weigh as much, and you can put it on the overhead on the plane when you're going to fly and play some festival somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's so neat to be able to get those textures, because on Process of Belief, it's like the really like fuzzy, distorted sound. It's really unique. And just being able to have access to different sounds, I think, gives the music such a good variance.
Yeah, for sure. And that was when we were recording with Joe Barisi, who is an incredible producer and has the most insane gear collection in the world. This guy has, I would, hundreds of pedals and all the good ones. And he has 50 guitars and 100 amps, you know. And he loves creating records where he's, oh, I found this weird amp that I forgot about in this storage locker. Let's see what this sounds like. It was very, that was where we learned the word shootout. Because with the Barisi, like if you pick you have a guitar sound, okay, well, let's shoot it out and let's take this weird Vox AC100 that I think still works and see what it sounds like. It was just so much fun. Gearhead, cool. Gear nerd fucking festival.
Yeah. It must be awesome to get in a studio with a guy like that, because then you feel free to just be like, let's try it.
Yeah, sure, 100%. Why not? Yeah. I love that. I love it.
And that's awesome.
They know, you know, Brett and Joe and Rick and all these people, they just know so much more about this process than I do. I mean, I'm really just like, I know how to play a guitar through an amp, but the recording part is not really, you know, I don't know the ins and outs, you know, that they do. at all. And so it's great to watch them make greatness out of some shit that I brought in. I love it.
I'm always impressed by people who can listen to amps and like be able to pick out like tones and sounds and warmth and all these things that I'm like, yeah, it sounds loud. Like,
yeah, I know. I'm right there with you.
I'm happy with it. I want to move into the song A Walk. So that song, A Walk, saw radio airplay. I heard it actually on a Boston station. I'm about 2 hours out of Boston. And so getting those songs on the radio, I know you've had some songs on K-Rock before, but nationally getting songs on the radio, how did that impact the band, the sales of the record, the tour?
Well, it makes people more aware of who we are. And we've had a number of national singles, but we've never had some, you know, major hit, really. It's been, you know, this has been a slow build. A Walk was great. It had a good video at a time when video still mattered to people. And the main reason it was great for us is that it made people figure out this is not a new band. And you go back and you listen to, you know, I have to say, and I can say it because I wasn't there for most of it, but this fucking band's catalog is insane. Yeah. So if you get turned on to a record from the Gray, you know, the Gray Race, and then you figure out about all of this of, you know, you figure out about Against the Grain and No Control and all of that. It's like, whoa, that's a big, big piece of, you know, that's a huge sandwich. And I think it just helped, you know, continue to make us more popular and to have more people listen to what we're talking about. There's no loss there, you know?
Yeah, it brought a lot of people in. I mean, myself included, hearing that on the radio. And
yeah.
And then to go back and discover, holy shit, these guys have a ton of records.
Yeah, and I remember when I did that solo, the solo sounds like a Cars keyboard part. It really does. And I'm sure, like, I would like to think, like, well, I just figured because Rick was there. And I know what it really was, which was probably, like, I played a solo. He kept half of it and went, okay, could you give another shot at the out at the end? And eventually it turned into just what he wanted to hear, which would, of course, right, be a Cars keyboard solo. But
he walked you through it. Yeah, long notes.
I'm sure that it was a combination of everybody. I wouldn't have just walked in there with that. Also, I make That's it up awesome. On the fly. Like, I don't write solos. I make them up when they, okay, go. And then I...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't write them. And they just... If I'm lucky, I get one in a couple takes. If I'm unlucky, we have to cut it up. And I have to drop in and like fix a problem or whatever. And then at the end, when I play it live, I make it up again. Like I don't play the ones that are on the record. I just don't. I don't know. I mean, I try to be, if there's a theme to them, like a Walk solo, if I play it live right now, is going to be pretty similar to the record because you can hum it. But the solos that are just kind of like wankle, you know, noodling.
Those
shit,
fast ones. Yeah.
Yeah. At this point in my career, like I slow that shit down. You know, and I just make it like I try to make it just more you know, more listenable. Like the time for that fast stuff is like, it's so over, and there's so many people. There are people who probably live within 300 yards of this house who can do it better than I do. Being good at that fast stuff is a skill I just never had.
And especially in the studio, where I feel like, I mean, live is one thing because you're kind of up there and you're feeling it. The studio, it's like you're under the microscope. I always get nervous, you know, like
I play better.
I feel like I get less creative when I'm in there.
I get more creative because I'm sitting fucking down and no one's watching me. And the guitar sounds amazing. Like I track in the control room. I don't track with, you know, when I can, if at all possible, especially if you're doing overdubs. I'm sitting at the desk with a producer next to me. So I'm hearing this amazing mix and this amazing guitar sound, and it makes me play better. No headphones, no like, hold on a second. You know, none of that shit. When you
can no metronome.
Yeah, none of that. And I play better. I always play better than I do live. Live is a whole different thing. It's like standing up and running around, trying to look cool, can't hear anything.
Sweating.
Yeah. You know, it's a show. It's a live thing. I'm living it. I'm not trying to recreate a record. I mean, that's not what punk's about. It's certainly not Bad Religion. Empty causes,
dive into this art a little bit. So you mentioned earlier that you weren't wild about this. I've heard that these are employees over at Atlantic. Is that what this is?
I think that they are. I don't know who's, you know, the title sucks and the cover is not very good. It's a testimony to the quality of Rick's work that the record still is successful. But that's when you get into stuff, you know. I mean, that's by, I said, by committee. And it's like, you know, it's a lot easier to have cool titles and record covers if the member of one of the band members owns the record label, say Epitaph. And the way people want to, you know, it's just like, there's no, you know, second prize is a set of steak knives at Epitaph. Like, this is Brett's band and we're going to make sure it's fucking cool. And at Atlantic, we were one of 150 bands and we just, you know, that just kind of fell through the cracks. I mean, I don't know. I can't list the titles of songs off the Gray Race, but I guarantee you that just in song titles alone, there's a lot better album title than the Gray Race. I'm pretty sure of that.
Let's name it the first song.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, but this has happened my whole life. You always think about it later. At the time, it's like what it is. And you're not, you know, I'm not a marketer at all. I play guitar. And so
is that what it's based on? Like being able to market it? I mean, is that like the theory behind these people sitting around at a table with you? Like, this is what you should do.
Well, the whole point of it is, yes, 100%. I mean, our job, look, the art stops once your record is done. And then they're selling a product and your record is now a product. And if you're lucky and you're on Epitaph, you have people who want to sell that product who also are fucking smart and cool and your friends. And don't like want to do, they don't want to do anything that's embarrassing. And they won't, because they won't even think of it, because they get what we're, you know, they get the whole point of this exercise. When in my experience with Bad Religion on a larger label, we didn't have that kind of comfort zone. We had a couple people who were fighting for us, but in general, we were just another band. You know, I've been on other major labels with other bands where we've had a team and had everything be cool. It's just, it really just depends. I mean, this is all a fucking crapshoot anyway. And I don't expect every person at Atlantic Records in 1995 to go like, this is my favorite record. I don't expect that. Like, it's not going to be. And you just, you know, you just get what you get. And the longer you do it, the more, you know, the better shot of getting what you get is exactly what you want. And, you know, go listen to Age of Unreason, our last record, and that's what we want. And it sounds like we want, it looks like we want, and it's the title says what we want to say. It's awesome. To me, I think it's great. I think it's our best record. And how many, you know, that's our 17th album. I think it's the best one.
Oh, I love it. I love the way it sounds. It's got a great sound to it. But going back to this for a moment, it must be so frustrating to have that, though, taken out of your hands, because this is, like you said, this is your art. It's kind of like, you know, you've got themes in mind, you've got these songs together, and then someone else is going to put like the face on it.
You can't be that precious about it, because it also, okay, we turn in the record. Now what's our job? Well, we've got to tour 200 days a year. Like, now I don't really like, especially at that point, like I didn't really, there was no time for that. Like, you don't, you know, that's the point. You need help and you trust this to your people. And you know what? We got a dumb title and a dumb record cover with great songs on it that a lot of people know and love the record. And we got on MTV and we go and we play our festivals and we got our head up. We moved up a complete notch from where we were before. So we won. Just nitpicking over the bullshit doesn't matter. It's like the end of the day, it worked out. And it's, you just can't be too precious about it. Like, oh, my poor recording. Fuck that. Let's move on to the next.
Yeah, I guess you can't be like that, because then you wouldn't get anywhere.
No, ever.
At least they didn't. I mean, I don't know. You said the title's dumb. I don't think it's too bad, but at least they didn't try to call it.
What the fuck is a gray race? What is a gray race? A gray race. What, are they aliens? Or is it a combination of black and what the? It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Here's an album title that I wouldn't use in 2022, but Streets of America. Well, there's an album title that you can see a t-shirt. Like, I mean, I would never use it now because it's so hard to, any hint of nationalism sends me running for my fucking shelter. But
Get America on
thanks
there.
for ruining that, you freaks, you fucking. God, I see a flag out and I'm like, what's wrong with this person? Look at this psychotic. It's like, God, why is it so like that? I remember
I know, we were just talking about that on
when I
this
was nine,
podcast.
I was nine. I loved the 4th of July. And now it's like, why did you take this
Damn
from
you.
us? Why did you take this from us? But,
I'm with you, man.
it's just what it is. It's fine. Let's not belabor it. I think everyone's gotten my point that I'm not
All
100%
right.
choked on the cover.
I want to get into this this European tour. You guys did this tour where you kind of played smaller venues in an effort to kind of recapture, the late 80s European tours that you did.
Well,
So
yeah, that's the first tour we did. And then we went back and played big places. And then we went back again
okay.
and played festivals. And then we keep, every band does that. Everyone, there's always the back to your roots tour. And you do it, especially when you're still trying to build. You want to keep doing that because it's really like I have gotten to see some really big bands play little tiny places, and it's just so fucking great.
Yeah.
It is so, to be in the
It's
audience for
special.
something like that is super special. I think as time passes, it might not be super special for the band. I mean, we still do it when we want to. I mean, there's, it's cool to do, but in general, like, it's still all about, there's still a hint of marketing there. And it's like my idea of a good show now is that we should play places that hold the amount of people that want to come see us and sound really good. And have people bring people with us that we think are great that we want people to see. Like opening bands are, we pick them on purpose. And a lot of times they might not even be punk, or it's just one person, or whatever. But it's, we're trying to like say, hey, check this out, and open people's eyes a bit. And it's still, that's the ideal situation for me, is not too
That's
big and
great.
not too big and not too small.
All right, and so playing these songs, do you remember what were some of your favorite songs off this record to play live? Or maybe to this day?
Well, at this point, you're going to just make me like call up the songs on my phone so I can
I've
actually
been trying to do that the whole
try to
podcast.
discuss this whole
Name five songs on the record, Brian.
Drunk Sincerity. And I haven't gotten it
That's
up
a good
on my
one.
phone yet. Drunk Sincerity, Them and Us, A Walk, Streets of America, Grave. I see I've already got them. All right, here we go. Let's see the names of these songs. All right. Songs we don't play that I love. Pity the Dead. What a great song. I love that. I love the hook. I like the story of the song. We when the record came out, we played 10 and 2010 a whole lot. And that was great. I mean, not only was Greg, as usual, pretty accurate and Nostradamus as far as population control, but that song is a ripper. That solo in it is super fun, and that solo on the record people think is a wah-wah pedal, and it's not. It's
Oh,
just
really?
no wah-wah. It's just the way my hands, just a weird, just tweaking. I don't know how I bent strings, how it happened, what the way the mics were in the room, the way things bloomed. It's not a wah-wah pedal. I remember later touring it, like a couple of years later, I had a wah-wah pedal because I couldn't recreate it anymore. And a wah-wah pedal is the best cheater tool in the world. Like, if you stall or trying to sound fast when you aren't, get a wah-wah pedal. It covers up everything.
Yeah, that'll cover it over.
I used one of those for like 10 years before even I couldn't handle it. I was like, this is lame.
Yeah. What am I doing?
I'm not fooling anybody with this. We still play Come Join Us
Nice.
almost
That's a
every
great song.
night. I love it. I love the intro. I like the song. I like what it says. I like the tempo. It reminds me of like the Ramones in a weird way. It's got that, it's kind of like, it's not as fast as you think it is. It has a cool pocket. And also when we play, a lot of times, we're not in the United States. I think we are, we are an international band, and Come Join Us is a great ethic And also, it's very simple to understand. People who don't speak English understand it. And it has the right meaning because it's really true. I mean, on every level. So that's a really great one that I still enjoy playing a whole lot. I gave Mike Dimkich the back half of the solo because I didn't feel like playing it, and he does a much better job than I ever did. You know, it's like when you get new people, make sure they're better like than you.
Yeah,
that was my trick. Getting Mike was like, oh wow, he's better than me. He can take all.
He can hand him off things.
I do all the time. It's like I don't feel like.
Well, it's good to share.
It is, and he still, you know, he likes playing solos, and I'm like, well, I mean, I'm fine with ones, but I don't really like. I want to sing, and I want to like. You know, I want to look at the people in the audience. Like, I'm kind of at that phase in my life. It's like I finally figured out how to sing a little bit like 5 years ago. Sorry. And so it's really fun for me. And I want to be engaged, immersed in the concert and not looking down at my guitar. So and Mike's last band, he never got to play any solos because he was in the Cult. And so Billy Duffy plays all the stuff. And so he was just a rhythm guitar player. So now he's really getting off on being able to do solos, so it's a win-win.
Perfect. Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, it's great. Song that we play a lot that I don't like playing is Punk Rock Song, because there's a solo there that's one of these hummable ones that has to be really accurate. That sounds like the Cars again, but it's really hard. It's really fast and has a lot of opposite picking, and so if you fuck it up, it's really embarrassing. So that one's hard because I know, okay, the solo's coming. You have
to. So you see that one on the set list and you're like, oh, there it is.
There it is. Yeah.
Three songs away, two songs away. It's next.
That song was a really big hit in Europe and we have to play it because that's, you know, if you're a band as old as we are, it is important that you play songs that were important to people, at least the right ratio of them. I mean, we always play new songs. We change the set list every night, but there are certain core songs that you have to play. And you can't be all like, well, I don't want to play that anymore. No, you're crazy, man. That was the soundtrack to somebody's life. You know,
someone came to see that song.
And they came to see that song, and not playing it for them is just selfish. It's not being cool. You know, we still play weird songs they've never heard before. That's fine. But they, you know, the 3/4 of the set should be songs when you have a catalog as big as ours that people know. And they love Punk Rock Song, and I'm here to play it every single night, even though it's really hard.
That solo. Oh, hey, you can pass it off to Mike.
You know, actually, it's a little out of his wheelhouse because it's a little too metal, and Mike is more of like a, you know, like a Ron Wood kind of player.
The melodic solos.
Yeah. He wouldn't want to do it. He would say, no, I'm not playing that.
Well, Brian, before we end today, is there anything from this time period of this record that we didn't cover that you think would be worth mentioning here?
There must be just so many if I could remember them. I'll tell you, there's a couple, just two things that are, well, one culinary thing is that we used to go, we'd come into the studio and we'd usually go get lunch before we would record. And especially it was a lot of it because, you know, you have the band do the rhythm tracks and then basically, you know, you're kind of focusing on guitars and vocals. So it was like Bobby and Hetson weren't really around as much. So it was like a table, you know, a smaller table. And we would go to this restaurant in the Village that was right by the studio every day. And I know it's closed now, but it was like Village Cafe or something like that. It was just like a diner kind of thing. And Rick would get a cheese omelet and French fries every single day. And so that was called the Ocassic. Because we went every day and it's New York. And of course they know who's eating breakfast with us, but no one's shitty about it. And so I would be like ordering things. Well, he'll have the Ocassic and I'll have this and that. And to this day, Jay and I you want to grab a McCasick? We call it that now. And we go get cheese omelets and French fries. And, you know, I mean, we've been doing that. And especially after Rick passed, it's like, it's so much fun because I think of him every single time I have a cheese omelet and French fries. And, you know, now in my life, that's kind of a special treat. I can't be eating like that anymore, but of course.
Yeah, not every day.
Rick was a rock star and he was perpetually skinny. And of course he can get away with it. But, you know, if I just live on that, it's just, you know, I don't want to be in Five Finger Death Punch. Like I'm supposed to look like a little fucking English kid, you know? So I can't do it anymore. But that was really, that was a great memory from that studio that week.
It's a great story.
Think about it every day.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much, Brian, for hanging out with me today. This was a lot of fun to go through this record. This record means a lot to me. It is the record that basically, I know it sounds cliche, but got me into this punk rock world and holds a special place in my heart.
Cool. I'm so glad to hear that because that's really, that answers one of the questions we were talking about earlier in the thing. It's like, what did that record do? Well, it got you into it and it kind of introduced you to the band. And that's, you know, that's what they're for. So I'm glad this was your entree. I think that's cool.
So when can we expect the new Fake Names record?
The new Fake Names record is going to be out March 3rd.
Oh yeah.
2023. And we have finished this record. And it is, the record is done. The cover is done. The singles are picked. The thing is moving. It's really exciting. And I think I love the record. It really sounds like hopefully what, you know, it sounds like the second record from Fake Names. But this time we've got Brendan Canty, who's joined the band. So we fooled Brendan to being in our band. And so we're writing and we're playing music and recording with Brendan. And it's just not only is because
like old times.
We all grew up together. So it's yet another one of this sort of like elementary school, early high school friends is in the group. But also he's fucking Brendan from Fugazi and he plays drums like a motherfucker. He's so good. And he just brings this thing, he raises this level. The songs just go to this new place. And so it's so cool that he's in the band and we're going to tour. We've booked out, we've got a couple weeks in April. We're going to tour in the US, which will be amazing too. Like to go, we're going to play like a real band and go play shows like a real band.
Wow.
And it's just,
that's great.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of got screwed with COVID because our last record came out right at the beginning of the pandemic and we had these plans, but we just never got to realize them. And now we're going to be able to go out there. And it's really great because we have two albums now. So we can actually like headline a show. So we can go and play a proper show instead of, you know, 30 minutes. We can play our 50, you know,
full set list.
Make it worth the $20. We can play, you know, we have enough music for you.
No cover songs.
Yeah. Which is no covers. Which is great.
That's great.
Yeah. So we're really excited about that. I'm really happy with how it came out. The record is called Expendables, obviously on Epitaph Records, and it will be out March 3rd.
That's great. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Hope you like it.
All right, Brian. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you, Jed.
Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Let's talk in a year.
Nice.
All right. Cool. I'll see you, man.
Awesome.
Bye.
Yeah. Okay, I would like to thank Brian for hanging out with me today and taking me through this record. What a thrill. I would like to thank Christina White at Mutiny PR for connecting me with Brian. I'd like to send a huge thank you to Krista Makes from Less Than Jake for the theme music. Make sure you check out episodes 5 and 56. Episode 5 on The Process of Belief with my friend Andrea, and episode 56 on Suffer with Nate Goyer from the Vinyl Guide podcast. Great podcast. Make sure you check it out. I'd also like to send a huge thank you to all of you. Thank you for tuning into this podcast. I really enjoyed diving into these fantastic records, if you couldn't tell, gathering up as much information as I can and putting it into this podcast. Check us out on the socials, say hello, suggest albums, tell us how you got into Bad Religion. All right, everybody, take care.